Blog Talk Radio. Imagine being born during the Islamic Revolution in Iran, being confined to wearing a heavy outer garment to cover your entire body, and then breaking free from these traditional customs and restrictions. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, healing through love, relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love. Author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of the Healing Through Love Lessons. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who keep proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. So Anahita June's feminine leadership as a priestess, healer, and spiritual counselor was the culmination of 25 years of study with mystic masters, exotic dancing, and her own training and facilitation. Anahita activates the sacred leadership of women who are ready to unleash the force of nature within. So I am really thrilled to talk with you today, Anahita June.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. So happy to be here. Thank you for that beautiful intro.
Thank you. You're welcome. Anahita, you spoke in a TED Talk, and you had invited me to speak on your summit, so I went to look at that TED Talk, and I was just blown away. So I can't wait for you to share with our listeners about your personal journey from those early days growing up in Iran to how did you begin to study and research with masters and shamans and get to do exotic dancing and then lead women to feel their own feminine power?
Wow, okay.
So just a brief overview of it. How did it happen?
I'll say there's so much that I'm grateful for, and a large part of it is my mother and her journey. You know, I'm so aware of really the generations, you know, how we raise each other up and how there's greater healing opportunities and empowerment opportunities to each generation. So obviously I had a challenging time growing up in Iran. There's really no freedoms for women. It's practically like you're a criminal, you know, like you can't dance, you can't sing, you can't feel the wind in your hair, you can't feel the sunlight on your legs or your shoulders. It's just cover it up, be quiet, don't express. So just heavy, heavy, heavy oppression. And this wasn't just my experience, obviously, it was also my mother's experience. And it wasn't her experience growing up because, you know, not to that extent because she lived during the Shah regime. She was a seeker, and so she left. I didn't grow up with her, but she did. She was on a path of trying to heal herself because there was a lot of trauma in the family. And one of the things that she went to early on was the meditation practice of TM. So she was going to India, and she was, you know, going to long meditation retreats. And this is when I was very young. There was a TM community in Tehran. So she would come back. And, you know, like I remember she came back, I had my first initiation into TM when I was 5, but she wasn't living with me, like, you know, she wasn't raising me. Then she came back again, I had my adult initiation into TM when I was 10. So I started meditating from a very early age. And so that was kind of, I think, an important seed that allowed me to stay centered, you know, because it was actually, that was during the war as well. So there was, they ran an Iraq war, which went on for the, you know, my whole life until I was eight. So that was a lot, you know, growing up in the war and being a young girl and, you know, not having my mother and all of this other stuff. So that was the beginning of me being a seeker and then also feeling the pain of what it is to be oppressed, which any of us would feel if we're experiencing that level of oppression of, you know, I could step outside and if my head covering fell off, like I could, no joke, have a, you know, a gun pointed in my chest, you know, military police, big rifle pointed in my chest as a young girl to pull up my hair covering. So so that was the growing up. And I came to the States. My mother moved to the States, and eventually I came to the States when I was a teenager. I was 14, and continued to be a seeker. You know, I continued to want to learn and want to understand. But there was just this interesting thing, you know, growing up in Iran, I always fantasized about living in the States. I saw these movies where, you know, blonde women would drive around in convertibles and the wind would be in their hair and they would wear bikinis at the beach. And, you know, we had these like indoor pools that were, you know, either all female or all male. And there was no, you know, there was really no socializing with the opposite sex. And so I was so excited to live in America, and I got here, and it took a while. It took a few years for me to understand that even though the external oppression had been taken away, I actually didn't know how to be free. It didn't matter that now I was free externally. I mean, it did to a certain extent, but I didn't know how to be free because that's just not the conditioning that I had had. So there was a lot of the oppression that was internalized. The way that I talked to myself or the freedoms that I thought I had or didn't have, you know, like I remember like in ninth grade, I had a friend who wanted to start wearing makeup, you know, and she was, her family was from Iran. And I remember like the stuff I said to her was you could have sworn that one of the Islamic mullahs came through my mouth and, you know, I was regurgitating some Islamic doctrine to her around how she was like a slut if she was going to wear lipstick, you know, in ninth grade.
Wow.
So there was just so much programming that I had to undo, and I could see it. I started to be able to see it because I was also, my mother was still, you know, very much on her journey of growth. And so she would kind of, as she went to her personal development courses, you know, she would take me to them. And so I was still, you know, I was becoming self-aware, but there was still a lot of unresolved stuff internally. And, yeah, so that's the first part. And
I just like to react. Can I just react to that part first? Well, the first thought I had as you were talking is that if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. So that's one experience you had at a very young age. But the other piece for everybody to realize is the power and the influence that a parent has. Your mother had a huge influence, even though she wasn't living with you all the time. You saw her opening up, and it gave you permission or freedom to do that eventually.
Oh, absolutely. And we've just been such great teachers for each other, you know, really helping each other to continue to become more free. And, you know, for a long time it was her, and then it sort of shifted and it became me. But, you know, I followed a lot of what I thought was expected of me. Like I got married really young. I got married at 21. I thought I should have a stable life. I married an all-American young man to have the all-American life. Like, how can I just, it just seemed like the thing to do. How can I become American? Because the life that I had was just not good. There was no room in it for me. And it seemed that the life that I created from this place of what I thought I should do still didn't have a whole lot of room for my spirit. And I'm a pretty wild spirit. Mm-hmm. I've always been a wild spirit. So once that marriage came to a completion, which was pretty quickly, we had been together for 4 years through college and he was my first love. And then we got married and broke up pretty quickly. I went through a really big dark night of the soul because this was the first time where I realized, like, I'm going to have to face myself now. It's not going to be fixed with some personal development workshop. It's not going to be fixed by, you know, it's just the hormones of falling in love and, you know, the dopamine running through my
right.
head. That I now have to feel how alone and lost I feel. And I was really very close to, I mean, I was not really wanting to live. It was very, very hard. And I was on my knees quite a bit. And that was the time where I don't really know how else to say it. You know, I started having these activations at night, these sort of tantric initiations, a lot of energy being poured into me and having these, you know, very sexual, orgasmic, fantastical dreams and waking up in orgasms and, you know, just dripping between my legs and writing like sacred poetry. And I was 22. And so this just was happening. And through this Snark Night of the Soul, and I started being, and I was studying, I had found some new spiritual teachers, but it started, I started being downloaded a lot of information. And it was kind of a lot of information about permission and the importance of sexual freedom and the importance of sexual healing and understanding what that really is and how incredibly connected that is to our power. But I was so young, and yet I was being downloaded so much, I didn't know what to do. I remember I was following, one of the teachers I was following was Marianne Williamson. And I remember saying to her that I felt like, I said something about how much is like being downloaded into me. And she said, you feel like, what are you saying? You feel like you need to write a book. And I was like, yeah. And she was like, okay, well, just, you know, start seeing how much of what you're being downloaded you can implement into your own life. And, you know, this is the thing. I'm so grateful for just that bit of wisdom at that time, because I'm so grateful. I don't believe that we need more teachers who tell us things, who are downloaded things. I believe we need teachers who are the embodiment and the living of their teachings, that they are the teaching. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's what raises the consciousness of the planet, and that's what people really respond to. So the next, the rest of my life became about integrating those teachings, but really I spent about 2 years when I had the downloads, when they began, I spent about 2 years just very clearly establishing this relationship with what I can only call the goddess, the face of the divine feminine. And I started listening really deeply and doing whatever I was guided to do. You know, it was just, it was constant. You know, I was driving to open, I had two jobs. One of them was Starbucks in Malibu. And I was driving to open this coffee shop at 5 a.m. or it was 4:30 in the morning up the Pacific Coast Highway in California. And 22 years old. And it was like the crown of my head opened up and these words just poured in from the top of my head. And they said, it just said, I give thanks as the light of the goddess and the light of the goddess and the wisdom of the enchanted feminine spirit shine through me and as me for the betterment of all. And it just poured in and it just started, it was like, it became the background, like elevator music, that frequency of those words became the background of my consciousness. And so I spent 2 years, you know, following. And then I was guided to go spend some time with my mother, who was living in Washington, D.C. And I had a job lined up. And 9/11 had already happened after these 2 years. So I'd become more of an activist. I was really engaged in, you know, the peace movement. I had flown to D.C. and lobbied for a peace bill. I was, you know, becoming really engaged in that way. And so I had gotten a job with an organization that did a lot of work for women globally, women's rights organization in D.C. And so I moved to D.C. It was a couple of months. It was like, oh, you start, you know, like in, I don't know, 45 days or something. So I was driving cross country. And anyway, by the time I got there, they had lost a major part of their funding, like major, which included my position. So there was no more job. And
wow.
And it, you know, yeah. So a couple of weeks goes by and I, you know, a couple of weeks of me applying for these, you know, sort of NGO nonprofit jobs, kind of what I thought I wanted to do. And nothing opened up. So, you know, I'm 24, I guess. Yeah, 24. And I figured, well, I might as well just get a waitressing job. Like, I need to make some money, you know, while I figure it out. So I went into this, what I thought was a restaurant, and it turned out to be a gentleman's club, a strip club. It was not a restaurant, you know. And I had already, I'll say, you know, waitressed in strip clubs occasionally because I was always fascinated. I always knew, along with those downloads came like a really deep curiosity of, you know, why is this beauty tucked into the shadows and shamed? Because when I go in there, all I see is like beautiful women and their sensuality and dancing. But why is it under all of this shadow and shame? I just didn't understand that. So that's the curiosity that had me, you know, having explored the scene as a waitress before. And I went in and, you know, the owner was like, we're not hiring any waitresses, but you're beautiful if you want to dance. So I mean, I didn't say yes immediately. I went home and prayed about it for, I think, you know, a week or 10 days. And I was really clearly guided at that point by that same guidance, that same, you know, the goddess who had been guiding me just said, you know, you're going to go and you're going to dance and you're going to claim your freedom and you're going to send it back to your ancestors. So my journey of becoming an exotic dancer was very different than a lot of people's. First, there was a couple of things. First of all, it was a place across from the U.S. Pentagon. So it was a really interesting energetic. The clientele were really intelligent, powerful men, the most powerful men that, you know, are running this country. And because of the laws of the state of Virginia, this was in Arlington, you know, it was just such a PG-13 place. So I got to experience the eroticism of being an exotic dancer dancing on a stage. But I'm also such an empath and a tender soul. I didn't have to do a lot of the things that a lot of strippers have to do, like table dances and private dances. And, you know, I basically danced on a stage and got paid to, you know, mingle with people and drink champagne. So it was interesting because, you know, I know this isn't the majority of people who dance, women who dance with experience, but I was awake. And I was fully knowing of what was happening when I was dancing. And I would, you know, I would dance and I would go into ecstasy. And, you know, I was having the time of my life. It was like I was finally experiencing freedom.
It's amazing how we go on a path because you weren't choosing this path. You weren't looking for it, but it found you.
Oh, absolutely. I was actually, it was quite challenging those 10 days that I came to the decision. It's not like the goddess said, you go and do this and send the freedom back to your ancestors. And I said, okay, that's not exactly what happened. I kept getting the guidance and I was really upset because I still had, well, there was some programming and there was definitely some things around, oh, this is the objectification of women. And it was just not what I saw myself doing. Even though I had waitressed in those places before, it was like, well, I'm waitressing, I'm observing, they're the dancers. So even though I envied the freedom that I saw the dancers having, I still held myself in a very different way. Like I had all of the spiritual contact and connection and I was a seeker, I'd gone to a Buddhist university, all this stuff. And I, at the time, it's so funny to me now because I was 24 and I was an awake, young, like magical 24, but still I was 24. And I thought that it was such a blow to my ego to be repeatedly guided to go take the dancing job when all my ego wanted to do was to be doing the work that I'm doing now in the world. So I thought that I should be doing what I'm doing now then, right?
But it doesn't work like that. We really have to have the life experiences, like you said,
correct,
to embody it.
Yeah. It's just such a no-brainer now because I don't have to sell my students that I'm their teacher. They know when they come because they have an experience that I am what I am guiding them to be, that I'm not just having just received some download and telling them, this is what I understand. It's more like, this is who I am, and this is what they're responding to. It's just a completely different thing, but it took a lot of years, like you said, the life experience.
courage to just do this. So I have a few questions about that. One is, how did you learn to dance? Did somebody teach you, or did you just get up and naturally do it?
No. No, nobody taught me. There was a time around the earlier time when I was having the tantric initiations back in Los Angeles that I had a good friend who was a dancer, and we were exploring our eroticism, not in a sexual way, but there would definitely be times where there would be like sexy music in the house and we would start crawling around on the floor. But I didn't know how to dance like that, because actually when you want to dance sensually, you have to move about at a tenth of the speed of a regular dance. So I was a trained dancer, but that doesn't mean you're an exotic dancer, because as a dancer, you move to a different beat of the music. When you're an exotic dancer, you know what they say to, it's so funny, because when a new woman would start, a new girl would start, and we knew she didn't know how to dance, the feedback we always gave her is like, slow it down, slow it down. Like, they want to see you. They don't want you to just, you know, be dancing like you're dancing at a club. But I, you know, so yeah. And I'll say this other piece. When I was 17 with my first love, who I ended up marrying, I watched a movie with him and his family that was like a benchmark moment in my life. And if there's anyone listening who hasn't seen this movie, and if there is a place where you are curious about your own relationship to your own eroticism, I highly recommend it. And the movie is called Dangerous Beauty. Have you seen it?
I think so. It was a long time ago, though.
It's a story about this beautiful courtesan in 16th century Venice. And I remember seeing this movie, and there was something about her, because this woman who had to, by the circumstances of her life, was forced to become a courtesan, turned this into her advantage. I mean, she could, you know, she could get a king to give them like ships for war. She had every man in Venice, Italy, in love with her, like all the most powerful men. So when you say, how did you learn to dance? It wasn't even as much about the dancing, because when I saw this movie and I saw what she did in the movie, which is that they all fell in love with her, there was a part of me, and I feel like this was recollection from past lives, and, you know, this is definitely the theme of eroticism and sexuality has been through many of my lifetimes. So I just remember watching that and wondering, like, how did she seduce all these men, you know? So I wanted to know, and I got the experience of, I wanted to know if I could seduce like a room full of 100 men just by dancing. And it was an amazing power trip. It was like taking my power back from all the oppression. It was really having a deeper understanding of, you know, the relationships between men and women. So that was, it was like the dancing was for my personal liberation and ecstasy. That was the inner focus of what I was doing. And then the outer focus of it, it was kind of ego, at least partly, that was curious, like, you know, that wanted to know that I could get a room full of 100 men to stop talking when I go on stage and just turn and watch me for a couple of minutes. And
you
that
said
was,
that
was what I, oh yeah, that was a lot of my experience, and it was such a high. I mean, you know, not everybody could do that, you know, and it was because I was awake and I was having a mystical experience, but I also knew about energy and I knew how to shift the energy in the room, because, you know, there's dancer after dancer. Every 5 minutes, the stage changes. And so it was like I knew how to work the energy in the room to be able to do that. And that was a, you know, a power trip as a young woman. And it was just taking my power back.
So now I have a question about, did you connect with any Iranian men or men from your culture and your family? How did other people react to the fact that you were doing this exotic dancing?
Well, you know, I did connect with some Iranian men. There was actually, I had a couple of Iranian lawyers who came in, and I was dancing to some Middle Eastern song when they came in, and they just, you know, they fell in love. So they would come and they would buy lunch for me and all my dancer friends, and we would drink champagne on Friday afternoons for like 5 hours. They would give us lots of money, and it was great, because I was such an anomaly to them. I mean, that's not what they see, you know? So,
yeah.
And then I was also leading a double life, because I was teaching yoga and coaching during the day, and I was dancing like on the side. And, so not a lot of people knew that I was dancing. It really wasn't something that I fully came out with until about a good 5 years after I stopped. It wasn't,
yeah.
It wasn't really something that I shared.
So it wasn't until you stopped that you really talked about it.
No, because, well, it was really my own, it was my own journey. And my mother knew, and my aunt knew, and they came and watched me, and they were very supportive. But besides, I mean, I really only shared it with people that I felt like could hold and understand that this was a sacred part of my journey. I wasn't interested in trying to explain to somebody like my father, who I knew just had a primary concern about me being his daughter and whatever, that I wasn't interested in trying to explain to anyone else that I knew this was a critical part of my path, because I had no proof. I had no proof of how the future was going to turn out. You know, I just had a knowing. So it was really important to keep it sacred for myself. And also there were still pieces where I wasn't totally okay with it. Like I knew I was guided to be there, but of course there was a part of me that wondered, like, am I crazy? Like, am I ruining my life? Like, what am I doing? You know, that was also there.
Right.
While the knowing was also there. So it was that when I fully integrated, when I fully became the embodiment of that, this wild primal part of me is just as divine and deeply connected to this devoted woman of this woman of devotion that I am and have been my whole life, in love with God and spirit. Like, once those two pieces really clicked in as one inside my body, then I stopped, because I didn't need it anymore. I was like, I got what I needed to be the teaching. And then took about 5 more years of still just focusing on teaching in yoga and coaching and not specifically talking so much about this piece, until it was like, okay. It was, I just was like, okay, it's time to talk about it. Then I told my father and, you know, started just bringing my work online, and then the TED Talk, which is more recent, and, you know, so on it goes.
So how did that TED Talk come about?
How did it come about?
Yeah, how did you end up doing this TED Talk and doing such a powerful talk?
Thank you. Well, about a year before I did it, I knew that it was time to give a talk. So I reached out to a woman who I highly recommend. She's a women's speaking coach named Casey Baker, who is now a dear friend of mine. And I knew I looked at a few different women who coached, you know, women in their TED Talks, and I just knew she was the one, because she holds a lot of the similar erotic energy. And so, and she's also very highly regarded. And so I was like, okay, this woman can help me birth this talk. But I still didn't know exactly what the talk was going to be, because the talk that we ended up writing together was a 30-minute talk. And you get to see 11-minute version of that, which is missing.
Mm-hmm.
It's missing some stuff. But I remember we had this 3-day private intensive in Sedona, and I remember her saying to me, like early on, you know, because I was sharing some stuff with her and she was being moved to tears as I was talking. She's like taking notes, but then she's crying. And she said, so I'm just curious, how far to the edge are you willing to go? And I just looked at her and I said, I'm willing to go all the way to the edge. Let's go. And, you know, that was that. Like, that was the talk. And then a time passed, and I ended up speaking on another stage, and on that stage I was speaking about something else, but one of the speakers was she was in committee for this TED Talk, and she ended up pulling me in for that, so I was grateful.
Yeah, so what I'd like to know is, what have you learned about men from your experience of dancing for them?
you know, I've learned how incredibly magical women are to men. And it doesn't matter your figure or your size or your age, that they really want to be enchanted. I've learned they want to be enchanted and mesmerized, and they are mesmerized by everything that is the feminine. They just, you know, they really want to experience us in our surrendered state. They really want to. It's like there were times where I would be dancing and there would be men sitting around my stage looking like they were praying, the way that they would have their hands interlocked and they're leaning into their elbows. And that was me just going into a state of ecstasy. And so I know that it's challenging living with men because you've got to tell your husband to take out the trash and fix the door and hang this up and take that. But really what, you know, I remember there were so many men that would come in and just say, you know, my wife emasculates me. And like really just what they want to experience is our softness primarily. And they want to be trusted. And they want to see that they bring a sparkle to our eyes. I mean, and then I learned a lot about power dynamics.
So what would you tell women? And what do you tell women to help them keep their men feeling mesmerized?
Take care of yourself. You know, take care of your spirit and your body and have sacred alone time where you get to breathe and be in nature and connect deeply with your own. You know, the thing is, when a woman comes to a man full, where she's not empty, you know, and she's truly connected with herself and her sensuality and her body, I would say, you know, have a self-pleasuring practice. Be fully, fully pleasured in every way you can be. And then bring that full cup of pleasured, alive female body and soul to present in your interaction rather than any misconception that there might be that, you know, I shouldn't have a self-pleasuring practice. I shouldn't fill myself up in all these ways that are maybe sensual and erotic because that's what I share with my partner. That's what I save for him. Because then, you know, we come from that place of emptiness. But when you come and you're full, it's just a completely, I mean, they just respond so differently when they know you're not empty, and you respond so differently when you know you're not empty. So I would say that's a key practice, solo time, nature time, breath, self-pleasuring, and showing up full.
And I have another question around this. What would you say to a woman who discovers that her husband's been going to strip clubs or exotic dance clubs?
Yeah, I would have a conversation, you know, of what is it that you're looking for there that you're not getting here. And it might sometimes, you know, for like, it's different for everyone. For some men, it's a distraction. It's like, you know, there were many men, like, you know, I remember like a lot of guys from the World Bank, there were these happily married men. They would come and they would be there for an hour, you know, on their Friday afternoon. So I would ask, like, what are you getting there? It might just be a distraction. If they're going very regularly, I think woman has different choices. I mean, there were plenty of male friends that I made who frequented the club whose wives and girlfriends knew that they came and I had met them, you know, like they would come, the wife would come occasionally and have a beer and, you know, we knew each other. So it wasn't like, you know, it was some secret. And then there are some women that are so incredibly like in the judgment of that whole thing. It's like they view it as so misogynistic. They've bought into the shame. Like they've bought into everything that has put the strip club in a dark corner, and they totally buy into it. Oh, it's the objectification of women, and it's misogynistic, and it's this and it's that. And they're also perhaps really disconnected from their own sexuality and sensuality. And so when that happens, then the man doesn't feel like he can share it at all. Like there is no opening. And so I would say then that it's a good time to take a look at, you know, to take a look at yourself. And if you're with someone who has compulsive behavior, if this is a compulsion for them, then that's something else to look at. Like, how are you in this relationship and what do you feel like you deserve? Because just because I was a dancer, it doesn't mean I would tolerate being in a relationship with someone who had a compulsion to strip clubs. You know, there's healthy exploration and healthy entertainment, and then there's compulsion. So you just want to look and see what's there and how you're showing up in relationship and what you're willing to put up for with.
Wow, that's a really helpful explanation. Thank you. And now let's talk about your summit, this beautiful summit that I was excited to participate in because it's unique. To tell us what we can expect.
Oh, thank you. It's so incredible. It's the life-changing power of sexual healing and really an invitation to move beyond the past and create the intimacy, pleasure, and long-lasting intimacy that you desire. And I just keep seeing this over and over in my work. You know, I do a lot of creative leadership work with women. I also, you know, part of that, it is always informed in how they're doing in their relationships, what the relationship is to their voice in a, you know, male-dominated workplace, all of these things. And I see over and over again that if the connection to the sexuality, if the healing around sensuality and sexuality isn't there, which is a part of my work, you know, it's definitely like a piece of it. But I just see that the more disconnected that place is, the more other areas are suffering. And so it was really clear to me that I needed to put on this event, not even, you know, again, I don't believe that we need more teachers talking about teaching. I really wanted to bring in teachers, but allow them, invite them to share their personal journeys and their personal stories so that we can all see what the sexual healing and empowerment journey really is. I mean, there's stories about women asking their rapist for money to go to a sexual healer because the rapist is in the family unit. We talk about discovering your kinks and what is it to be kinky and what are your kinks and how do you share that with your partner, or what do you do if your partner's kinky and you're not, or vice versa? What's feminist porn? You know, how do you get turned on? What about erotica? To how to recover after rape and how to fall in love with your body and pleasure after you've been raped, how to support a partner to, you know, when they're going through their healing journey of sexual trauma, or how to ask support from a partner if you're the one who's having the trauma coming up and needing to be healed. You know, how to be multi-orgasmic, how to, you know, the importance of self-pleasuring, yoni eggs. It just goes on and on. It's such a powerful, powerful series. I feel like there's really something for everyone. It doesn't matter because the sexual healing journey, I don't feel like is ever complete, you know. The empowerment journey is certainly not complete. It's an evolution. Like, we all get to a place. I would say I have a tremendous amount of sexual freedom. But I mean, I'm always learning. I'm always discovering. My heart's always opening. I'm always experiencing greater ecstasy and intimacy and touching places where I'm like, whoa, I didn't even know this was possible. So I think it doesn't matter where you are on that journey. There's definitely something for everyone. And it was really fun to have you on there as well. Thanks.
Thank you. And you know, what I'm realizing as you're talking now is that each person grew up in a different time era, different lifestyle, they've had different experiences, and each one has their own unique sexual healing. Even if it wasn't traumatic like that, it's still, there are minor traumas and minor issues and repressions that can have a huge effect.
The repression is always there. And we even see, like, you know, there's a woman who shares absolutely to what you're saying, different generations, different socioeconomic backgrounds. Even we have some men sharing about what it's been like to support their female partners through their sexual healing when the women have been traumatized. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a woman sharing about how it changed her life because her father was so not shaming and able. Her father, when she was a teenager, was able to acknowledge that she was becoming a sexual being, which is the opposite of what most women experience. Most fathers even either try to oppress and suppress the girl becoming a woman, or they just put blinders on and pretend like it's not happening. Like, my little girl's not becoming a sexual being. Where her father, you know, talked to her about sex, but in a way of, listen, it can be really pleasurable and really special. And I really want you to know, because of how special it is, that I want you to do it with somebody that you love. He didn't say don't do it. He told her to do it with someone that she loved, and there's more, but the way that he approached it, it allowed her to be like one of the very few people that I've spoken to who had a phenomenal first time experience. you know,
mm-hmm.
which is not
That's
what you
beautiful.
Hear most about. Yeah.
So just say when the summit begins.
Oh, absolutely.
Just a little more about
the
it.
The summit. Yeah, you can definitely, you can sign up now, and we go live, meaning the sessions are going to be delivered once you sign up to your inbox starting on September 25th, and it's on, the website is thelifechangingpowerofsexualhealing.com, so you can just go there, put in your name and email address. You can also, if you have 11 minutes, watch my TED Talk, but put in your name and email address, and on September 25th, you will start seeing these stories, and they're just, you know, like I said, there's so many more than what I mentioned, women coming out of codependent, abusive relationships, and now being really free, empowered, and in every way. It's just so incredibly inspiring, and we have some beautiful men who are devoted to women's healing as well on the series. So, yeah, really beautiful.
Just
number
wonderful
25th.
Speaking with you. Yes.
Oh,
and I
thank
do have
you.
A link
thank
to
you
the...
for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I do have a link to the summit on the webpage here on the radio show also.
Beautiful. Well, I look forward to getting more connected with the audience here and sharing this, you know, just what I feel so passionate about, what I feel like we're all in need of is more freedom around our sexuality, regardless of age or, you know, life stages. You know, we have people talking about how to come back to your sexual intimacy and partnership when someone's had chronic illness or been diagnosed with a severe illness, and when they heal from that, if there's just something for everyone, truly.
Truly. And the aging process, how
mm-hmm.
that affects
absolutely
everything.
All of that.
It's not static. It changes throughout life. But that
mm-hmm.
basic healing is so important.
Well, our basic need to feel ourselves as alive human beings is so connected to our eroticism. And that does change, but it doesn't go away. And if it does go away, then I
mm-hmm.
just want to say you can bring it back.
Absolutely. So, Anahita June, what a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Oh, my joy. Thank you so much, Dr. Erica, for having me.
And to those of you listening, I'm Dr. Erica Goodstone, your host, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, drericagoodstone.com. You can see all the different summits on different topics that I have hosted and spoken on. And if you'd like a private Healing Through Love lesson, let me know. Bye for now, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.